Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today we have Tom McPherson of Summit Acquisitions sharing several stories on transactions he has facilitated over the last several years. The first transaction involves a business that had profits that dropped by nearly 50% in the year of the sale of the business, all of this while sales were increasing. Since this didn't make a lot of sense, to help figure out this conundrum, Tom suggested that the seller retain a forensic CPA to comb through the financials for answers. You'll learn what the CPA found that eventually enabled the seller to increase the sales price by over $500,000. Next, you'll learn about how two partners that refused to provide information to their M&A specialists cost them $1 million. Then you'll learn how a buyer that understands your business will enable you to get a lot more at the time of sale than a buyer that really does not understand your business. You'll learn about how being able to properly assess the level of risk is an important part in the sale of any business. This is Marvin L. Storm with the Business Exit Stories podcast. Today we're here with Tom McPherson. Tom, would you take a few minutes and introduce yourself today?
Thank you, Marvin. I've been a business broker in the North Carolina area for the last 8 years. Before that, I was in Atlanta. I lived there for about 30 years. And the last 8 years before, I was also a business broker. Before that, I was a CPA, did public accounting for Pete Mark Mitchell for a number of years, and then got into a couple businesses, started off with residential construction. I was a general contractor, got into that through a strange set of circumstances. I did that for a number of years before I eventually got into my major career in life, which was running a printing business for about 22 years. It was a small commercial print company. At the peak, we did about $4 million in revenue, had 30 employees. We had small format presses. And initially, it was like shooting ducks in a pond, Marvin. The customers came to us, and we did the work and got paid. And it was just like business 101. And then a little thing like the internet happened, and people stopped printing brochures, because they had websites, and they stopped printing stationery business cards because they had email. And the business, the industry in Atlanta, in the United States, went from 16,000 print companies to about 5,000 print companies in about 10 years. And I decided to get out in 2002, sold my printing business and got into business brokerage. Which for someone who had spent all the time in one industry that had evaporated seemed like a good direction for me, because I had bought and sold a number of printing companies during my career, had my accounting background, and could relate to business owners, the plight they have of working hard and not enough hours in a day to get all the jobs done that need to get done. So I've enjoyed the business brokerage industry. And I think we have four interesting stories for today.
Well, that's a interesting path to becoming a specialist in business brokerage, and one that sounds like you're well prepared for. So as we get started today, Tom, why don't we talk a little bit about some of those transactions that you've been involved in that, you know, maybe had some challenges to them and didn't go as anticipated. And let's talk a little bit about what the outcomes and takeaways for those transactions were.
Well, one of the more interesting ones was a tire and auto repair company that I recently sold here in the Carolinas. The business owner, like many of my clients, have come from corporate America. They learned a number of skills to run the part of a big business, and they wanted to stop missing the children's sporting events and plays, and they wanted to stay home, not travel, and apply their skill set to running your own business. And this gentleman had been in sales and marketing for a multinational company, and just decided to find a business and found one that suited him. It was a tire and auto repair company that was doing about $1 million a year, and he bought it about 7-8 years ago. And his wife did a little bit of the accounting work, maybe billing, not too much. And he was at the office every day, and with a couple of people, administration, and 6 bays of repair shop work. He was busy every day, and he eventually decided that his kids were out of college, about to get out of college, and he didn't need to have that extra cash coming every year, and he wanted to retire. He had saved enough money and was ready to retire. So he contacted me, and I started putting together the book.
So let me just understand here, as you've given a description of the seller of the business here in the Tato tire and auto repair business. He came out of corporate America with absolutely no auto experience whatsoever, and he's tackling a business that is heavily reliant on being kind of mechanically inclined, or that would be the assumption, but he didn't have any of that.
That's a good point, and it kind of relates to how I started. When I got in the printing business, I had no printing experience, but there were people on the line who knew what to do. And as long as you don't come across as being a know-it-all and ask them about things, you can kind of pick up what can and can't be done and how long it will take. And that's what this gentleman did as well.
So in this case, his personality, be sales and marketing oriented and people oriented, really was the key component to success in his business.
Absolutely. Yeah, it wasn't technical.
And I think that's a big takeaway for a lot of our audience here, to realize that you don't have to be a technician to succeed in your business and really understand how the internal workings of the business function on a day-to-day basis. But you really need to have people in place that understand those things, but that you really need to focus on the customer and relating to the customer and being able to secure the customer.
Absolutely.
Well, tell me a little bit more about why he decided to exit and what the process was as you prepared the business for sale.
Well, I typically prepare a pretty comprehensive book on every one of my clients, 50 to 100 pages. It's not 200 pages or anything like for a major company, but it has the history of the business, talks about the competitors, talks about the future, the opportunities for the business, maybe the weaknesses of the business. And we try to answer all the questions that a potential buyer may have about a business.
So do you think businesses that try to shoot from the hip and sell a business that don't have this type of book prepared that answers and addresses a lot of the issues that you know that are going to come up, that a type of book like this really does enhance the probability of getting the full sales price or close to it for the business?
Absolutely. It's a time-consuming process for me. It's about 14 pages worth of questions that I've developed over the years from business appraisers as well as buyers. And the most important thing, one of the most important things in sale of a business is momentum. if you can get a buyer interested in a business and you can get most of his questions answered in a 50-page document, then he's likely to move to the next step. And then if there's only a few questions left that he has to answer, get answers for, then you move pretty forward pretty quickly. Because if I found if people are unsure, if they don't know something, they tend to lose interest in it. If it's obvious to them what the business is about and what the history was like and what the future holds, then they're captivated by that and they want to learn more. So it's well worth the effort on my part. Well, during this process, I get the financial statements for the prior three years, and the most current year-to-date numbers. And I put them in a tabular form in an Excel spreadsheet, and I calculate the percentages of revenue of each item. And I show, and it's, you can look left to right and see have these numbers gone up or down in dollar amount, and have they gone up or down in percentage of revenue, whether they be cost of goods sold or admin expenses. And when I looked at this particular client, the prior years were just golden. It was just a steady increase. It was a kind of business that looked real nice, that a buyer would look at and say, gee, it's not wild fluctuations. He's got a business that's steady. If I could add some incremental efforts and increase the growth rate, that'd be great. And the problem came in when I started looking at the year-to-date numbers. And the year-to-date numbers just fell off a cliff. It was about 5 or 6 months into the new year. And I looked at it and I said to my client, what happened? This gross profit number is much lower than prior years as a percentage of sales. And that's translating to a real hit in the bottom line. And your business is currently on track to be worth about half of what it was for the prior 3 years.
So you're really saying that half the profitability, because it fell off of the cliff here, is really going to translate into half of value. So that's a big deal.
It was a tremendous deal. And it was disheartening because it was, everything looked good. He was happy about the price, the value, and no business owner is ever happy to find out his business is worth less than what I told him. But the results were, the financials were just telling buyers this is not what it was worth before. So I tried to, even though my back was accounting, I'm just not a forensic accountant. And I didn't have the time or expertise to kind of dig into the books. But I have a friend who's a forensic accountant, and I contacted him, and he and the owner talked, and he got a really good price. The seller did, my client, for this guy to come in and look at the books. And initially, I was sure it was some sort of employee theft. I mean, it was out of cost of goods sold. It sounded to me like the employees were taking material that had been purchased for out of inventory and doing repair work on the side. And there were some other people who thought the same thing, but we got into it, and the forensic accountant found about 5 different issues. It was never one big thing. Any big problems, usually a sum of other small problems, but he found 5 things that caused a decline in profit that could be explained to a potential buyer and help soften the blow and maybe help the buyer achieve a price close to what he was looking for originally.
Well, you know, when you first see this type of situation where cost of goods are really off the charts and out of whack, your assumption was probably right on, because that's one of the first things that you think about is something like that going on. And that wouldn't have been a surprise if the forensic accountant had found that. But you're telling me that that's not what he found. He found other areas which distorted the cost of goods sold.
Yes, the one of them that I don't know exactly, I can't remember which is the most important, but they all had similar values. The gross profit had declined in one case due to intra-year misclassifications. The prior year had some costs that should have been booked in a prior year in that December, but they got booked because of a vacation of the accountant at year end, and they didn't get booked until January of the next year. So it distorted one, made the prior year look better than it should have been, and made the current year look worse.
So obviously he's on a cash basis, and that will have a big impact on when you book revenue.
Well, in this case, that is true. In this case, they didn't bill the vendor. It was a vacation of the bookkeeper or the vendor, and she didn't send the bill. So there was no warning for that. They just didn't get the... In fact, they were waiting for the bill and asked for it. When they finally got it, my client just booked it the year he got it and then went about his business. Then the other misclassification was within the gross profit. It was an admin expense in the current year that got booked as a cost of goods sold, and we reclassified it. It didn't help the bottom line, but at least it showed that it wasn't a gross profit issue. And then there were some three things that the buyer was able to do that had been doing that caused problems that he could take corrective action for the rest of the year to some degree. There was one large project that needed to be done for one of his clients, and he had retail clients as well as business repeat customers, fleet contracts.
So when you refer to fleet in the automotive business, you have large companies that have multiple cars, or sometimes dozens, if not hundreds of cars, and those are fleets. They get some sort of preferential pricing because of all the business that they're bringing.
Correct. Preferential pricing and assured of a high priority in getting their work done. And my client had just taken a bunch of small jobs that were going to fill his bays for a couple of days. And his fleet client said, I've got this big job I need to have done. So my client took it to he jobbed it out to a competitor. And when he got the job back, he didn't mark up that job at all.
Why would he do that? That seems odd.
In this particular case, the client, since it was a fleet client, they kind of knew the market price for things. It was a fairly big job, and he had no labor to mark up, no material to mark up. And if he did, he felt the client would recognize that he was getting gouged just because my client was, his bays were filled up. So he just kind of ate that.
So it's kind of a good problem to have if you're so busy you can't have additional business. But in this case, the additional business that was waiting to be done was a fleet client, which was an important customer. And so he opted to job it out to another company to get the work done. And because the other company was charging more or less retail, there wasn't any margin for him to be able to mark it up.
Absolutely. And by itself, it wouldn't have been a big hit, but it was just one of those things that kind of added up. And then he had an unusual situation where he had a number of transmission jobs that came in the first 4 or 5 months of the year, and it was twice as many as he might normally have. And he had earlier decided as part of a policy that he wouldn't work on transmissions. He would job them out to the dealer, because he was concerned that if there was a problem with the transmission and he had bought the transmission from the dealer and installed it, there was no warranty on that transmission. And it was too big a risk for him to take, he felt. So he jobbed it out to a local dealer, and it was able to mark it up a little bit because they were to retail customers, but they were low margin jobs. And that just was a big chunk out of gross profit. And of course, the revenue was there, but the profit was almost non-existent, the contribution to the overall profit of the business.
What you're really saying is that none of these individual instances of misclassification, booking in the wrong year, jobbing it out, not being able to mark it up, jobbing it out and being able to mark it up some, all of these things in aggregate added up.
Yes. Yeah. Once we had the answers to that, it made sense. But two things had to happen. One is we had to have some sort of documentation from a reputable, believable professional of what had happened. And that's why we used a forensic accountant, so we could write a report documenting all that. And we also had to have from the forensic accountant his recommendations as to what to do to prevent these things in the future. Couldn't deal with the misclassifications. They were kind of one-off things. But the business practices of jobbing out and low-margin markups, we could make sure that didn't happen nearly as frequently. And we knew that the rest of the year, we had 6 or 7 months to go, the rest of the year, the impact on the bottom line would be diminished each month as the normal profits would roll in. So by the time the end of the year rolled around, he had maybe 3/4 of the profits he had the previous year, but he had a report as to what had happened, what unusual situations had occurred, corrective action taken, and we got 90% of the price we were going to get based upon the prior year's numbers. So it was kind of a win under unusual circumstances that in many cases would have led a buyer to just postpone the sale for another year until he had another year of good revenue and profits, or to take a haircut and sell his business.
So in this case, I guess forensic accounting really does pay off.
Yeah, it was I didn't know the return on investment, but it was the best investment he ever made, my client, that's for sure.
Well, that's cool. Well, why don't we go on to another transaction for you here that didn't work out so well?
This one didn't work out. It was a commercial residential landscaping company. It was started about 20 years ago by two guys who were neighbors. They were both businessmen who were kind of like the original owner of the auto repair company. They were road warriors. They had learned a bunch of stuff about how to run a business, and they decided to pull their respective resources together and open up a commercial and residential landscaping company. Their wives weren't involved in it, but one guy was more of an ops guy and supervised the crews and make sure the jobs got done correctly. The other guy was a board of admin guy who would make sure all the bills got paid and the material was ordered and make sure the books were done. And they were both really nice guys. They were in their mid-50s and decided they wanted to retire. They had grown the business because of their background in corporate America. They knew the value of building a brand. They made sure their trucks were clean, equipment was clean, the employees wore uniforms, and especially in the commercial sector, it gave those clients a feeling of comfort that dealing with a competent company. So they could charge a premium for that, and they were quite profitable. And like all my clients, I gathered all this material. I got the 14-page questionnaire answered and all the documents I needed, and I was putting together the book, and I noticed I like to use the books, the records that the client provides in their internal financial statements. And then I like to just do a reconciliation of the tax return to make sure that there's no major differences. And of course, there always are some differences, especially with add backs.
Why don't you explain to our audience a little bit about an add back is and why you add it back?
That's an interesting point. I threw that one out there. Typically, what a business is valued at is based upon a market multiple of the cash generated by the business. And the simple way to calculate that is to take the net income or loss of the business and add non-cash expenses or what are called discretionary items. A non-cash expense would be depreciation or amortization. A discretionary expense might be what the owner is paying for health insurance or key man life insurance. And even owner's compensation is considered a discretionary item because two owners might have the same exact business, but if one pays himself $400,000 and the other pays himself $100,000, one company is going to look better by $300,000. And a way to normalize those businesses to make them to show how they really are, you add back the owner's compensation into the add-back section to come up with a net number called owner's discretionary cash flow. And with larger companies, publicly traded companies, it's something similar. It's called EBITDA. I won't go into the details of the differences right now, but in any case, that's an explanation of add-backs. Well, this company had big differences in the revenue as well as the expenses of the business, and between the tax return and the internal financial statements. And I needed to make sure that these discrepancies could be explained to a buyer.
And again, you're saying that discrepancies aren't unusual necessarily. They just have to be explained.
Exactly. I mean, some of these were unusual when the revenue is different, then that's not an add back, but whatever it is, it needs to be explained. And if it's not explained, a banker is just not going to even make the loan, the acquisition loan. And in case if it was going to be sold, financed by the owner, he might say, well, I don't mind. I'll be happy to finance the transaction. It doesn't happen too often, but they do sometimes. But a buyer with any sophistication is going to look at the tax return and say, well, that's the number that I should be buying, the revenue that showed up in a tax return. That's conservative, but I feel comfortable with that unless you can tell me some reasons otherwise. In this particular case, I knew that the owners had spent some money on landscaping their own properties and that those expenses had run through the cost of goods sold. And that would be explainable and understandable and everything would be fine. But there were too many of these discrepancies. And when I made tactful inquiries from the owner, I just didn't get answers that I could put on paper that made any sense. They were more general and just not helpful. So I'd ask him again, and I would explain to him that I really needed to have an answer because I wouldn't be able to sell the business the way it was. Whether it was bank financing would be the hurdle or just the buyer alone would not be willing to accept to look at a piece of paper that I was putting in a PDF file was going to be more important than the tax return, which showed less net income. So it was frustrating because it was a really good business and I knew they were making money and I knew the explanations were available, and I won't speculate as to why they wouldn't give me the information, but I had to withdraw from the engagement. I just said, I can't sell it at the price that you want.
So what you're telling me really is that they wanted to sell the business based on their own internally generated financial statements and profitability, not on what the tax returns showed.
Correct. Absolutely. Right.
And so that delta was maybe $1 million difference in sales price between what they were asking based on what they represented and what the tax returns actually said. There's a big gap there. And they just were not willing to explain what those differences were.
And I try to explain, that's one of the frustrations in this industry. You're trying to provide professional guidance to a business owner who has expertise in his own business, and you're trying to explain what needs to be shown to get a buyer interested and eventually close a deal. And when they just stonewalled me, it was extremely puzzling. And I eventually talked to the accountant, and I couldn't get anywhere with the accountant either. So typically, it's not unusual. In fact, it's normal for business owners to flow through some personal expenses through their business. Sometimes it's done just modestly, and sometimes it's pretty aggressive. And I don't cast judgments on that. I just present the information and let the buyer make a decision what they want to do. But it's discretionary whether the owner is going to be running those expenses through. So it's fair to show that as an add back. So I wouldn't have mind listing all the add backs associated with these personal expenses if that was if that indeed was the issue.
So it appears like when you really started to explain in your role as an advisor what these ad backs were, I would imagine you sort of thought, well, maybe they just don't understand this and we can just walk through the logic of it and they'll kind of accept that and then I can disclose it. But even after going through this with them and even going to their accountant, you weren't getting any explanation. So because they wouldn't, they probably could have, but wouldn't give you the reasons for the differences, you just eventually had to walk away from the engagement and move on.
Absolutely. It was terribly frustrating because I'm kind of a logical person and I would think logic would win the day, but emotions, fear perhaps, in this case, was taken hold. And maybe they just didn't believe me. And they went to talk to somebody else who told a different story. Whatever happened, I haven't talked to him in about 18 months or so. So I don't know what's happened, but I knew I couldn't tell it. I don't know anybody of my peers. I'm in a best practices group of 14 other brokers around the country, and all would have walked away from it.
So I guess the big takeaway here is that there is really a need for full disclosure, and so differences can be explained away. And if you aren't willing to do that, the probability of you selling the business goes down substantially, probably in the 90-95% category, because no one is going to accept your financial statements versus what you're reporting to the government on your tax returns.
And in addition, it's best to disclose it in the very beginning. If you have to have someone go down through lots of investigation and find out something, and you know they're going to find it out in due diligence. I mean, at some point they're going to find it out. Then you have no credibility for that buyer again. So you've destroyed that. So if you want to disclose everything you can, all the warts, and sugarcoat it as well as you can, but if you try to conceal something, it's going to come out and it's going to bite you. And then you spend a lot of time in trouble.
Good takeaways there. Well, let's move on to a transaction that went really well, maybe even a little bit better than anticipated.
I represented a security integrator starting about 5 years ago. I had met him in a search I was doing for a company that was interested in buying a security integrator, and he wasn't interested in selling at the time. But I kept in touch, and he called me one day, and he said, I'm interested. And he's interesting character, just extremely bright, articulate, technical. He knows about the business and what clients need and what's available for them to protect their business. A security integrator, in this case, it's a physical security integrator, not cybersecurity. He would install cameras and card readers to make sure people didn't have access to places they shouldn't be. And he's doing work at a high level for major Fortune 500 companies and government installations around the Southeast. Really bright guy, had lots of interests and interesting things he was doing. And I really liked him, and he apparently liked me. And we would touch base frequently. And when he was ready to sell, we got into the books. He had just had his best year. But by the time I got all the information to start marketing the business, he also had a drop in his business. And the major reason was sequestration. About four or five years ago, the government shut down any new expenditures by the Defense Department. So you could even have a PO, but they had a budget that was going to be cut back to, I think it was 10% of the previous year. So any new projects were going to be difficult to get done. So he had a bad year. And
the bad year meaning that just things beyond his control, like the government having a cap on spending.
And we thought, well, maybe there might be some people out there who understood this and would know that it was a temporary thing, but there was no appetite. His business had dropped considerably. And even though somebody may have an understanding of why the business has dropped, they still have to pay the bills. If they buy a business and it doesn't generate enough cash to pay the note on the acquisition of the business, then they're out of business. So it just had dropped in value by about three quarters. So during this time, he had a strategy. He's always looking for new ways to grow the business. And he was aware of a program. He was just in the beginnings of this program with tribal entities where the government has set aside for a number of Indian tribes. And they set aside a certain amount of contracts they are obligated to give to tribal entities. And the tribal entity in his case would do the administration of the contract, but my client would do the actual installation. And he had this really like $25 million contract for 5 years. And this was a $5 million business. So it's really substantial.
So just to clarify, his business was at the $5 million a year level, and he secured this contract through the tribal entity program that he got involved with. And that contract was for $25 million. So, you know, five times as large as his annual business.
Exactly. And this is coming off of a bad year. So he was really excited about it. And I can't remember the actual terms, whether it was like not a blanket PO, but there's some government term with acronym for it. It was not a contract to do a specific thing for X amount of dollars. It was a set aside that they were going to spend $25 million of work to this tribal entity, but the tribal entity had to find out what specific opportunities there were that they could do to consume this, to earn this money.
So what you're saying, for clarification here for our audience, is that the government said, okay, we're going to spend with this tribal entity $25 million. Now you, the tribal entity, got to go out and find the work.
Correct. And it's a technical field. I mean, it's very difficult. And for them to get involved with a government military base and go through the language barrier of what they want and what these people don't know was just too great. And my client tried to work with them to try to get some work, and they got just a little bit, enough to taste that it was available, but they really couldn't get it scaled up to anywhere near what the potential was. So my client had kind of taken his eyes off the ball for a while and was really focusing on this tribal entity business. And then switch gears, we had a change in the sequestration, release of funds, and due to his contacts in the military, that business ramped up again like it had been before. And he ended up having a good year.
What you're talking about here, really, Tom, is that it's kind of a yo-yo type of business. One year it's down, next year it's up, then down, then up. And it's just very inconsistent because of the dynamics of the market he was in.
Yeah, the buyers don't like to, I mean, it's tough enough for sellers to deal with, business owners to deal with up and downs, but buyers are very reluctant. If they can't see a trend line that you know, three dots connected going upward, they kind of think it was going down. Where's the bottom? And so they kind of shy away from that. Now, if people are sophisticated buyers and know the industry, like this private equity group that came along, they can understand what happened with sequestration.
So you mentioned private equity. So explain that a little bit more to me. Were they specialty in this field?
And this company is an international peg, and they have a number of different industries that they focus on. And one of them is the security integrator industry. And they gather. I mean, it's a great fit for this industry because it's a very fragmented industry with a bunch of security integrators located in their own regions that do this work. But so many companies now, whether they organizations, whether they be business or industry, they're spread out across the country and the world, and it'd be nice if they could have one entity to deal with rather than every security issue has to be negotiated with a local vendor. So the idea of pulling them together under one umbrella is a pretty works out really well in this particular industry.
So the private equity was going out and acquiring all these securities integrators and assembling them in under one umbrella. And that's what the private equity group was doing.
Right.
So they really understood the dynamics of the business and some of the issues he was dealing with.
Absolutely. I don't want to say they pay more than an individual buyer, but in this case, they would pay more than an individual buyer. It was still something that could be purchased by an individual that size, but the individual might be so skittish about the risk that they wouldn't be able to offer the price that the private equity group would. And based upon the nature of private equity, they're buying businesses at small business multiples. When I say small business, it could be $5 or $20 million business. But since they've aggregated a number of these businesses together, their value is a higher multiple of the profits of all the companies in the entity. So they can afford, if they see a company that has really good growth potential, to pay a really good market price.
So I guess the real takeaway in this situation is that the buyer, in this case a private equity, really understands the business. So targeting the right buyer and the right seller together, magic happens, and they get a multiple that's reasonable, and in this case, more than reasonable given the circumstances he was dealing with.
Yeah, that is an important takeaway, and I really like the tenacity of my client. I mean, he went through some really tough times and tried a number of things and kind of got hooked a little bit on the tribal entity deal for about a year or so, but then came back and pushed on. He had confidence in his ability. A number of buyers or sellers think that their business is worth X amount of dollars just because of their hard blood, sweat, and tears over 20 years. And that's noble, but the end of the line, end of the day, the buyers are purchasing cash flow, not effort. And my client had effort, and it bore fruit, and he was patient enough to not blame me that his business wasn't worth as much anymore, and kept me engaged in the process as it grew it back up to close to what it was at its peak. Good guy, nice story, good ending.
All right, well, let's move it to wrap it up here and talk about another story that may have some takeaways to it.
This is a strange one I had never experienced before, and I don't know if your audience might relate to it, but it is, if you think about it, it's part of the future of business, buying and selling small businesses as our world gets smaller and smaller. I had an opportunity to represent a business, an owner of a natural stone distribution business in the Carolinas. There was gentleman who had emigrated here from the Middle East about 20, 30 years earlier, had experience in commercial construction at his home originally, and he came to America and started commercial construction business. And things were going pretty well, but he found a component in his commercial construction business that was difficult to get was some natural stone that was indigenous to his country, travertine in particular. He had marble and some other stones, but travertine was a unique stone that was mined particularly in his country almost exclusively. So he decided that he was going to set up a company to import that stone, and he would have it available for his own company and then sell it to other companies as well. And so he did that for about 7-8 years. And about 3 years ago, he asked me if I could represent his company. And it was kind of a neat business because most business owners that I meet are business, the buyers and sellers of businesses happen to be men. Just my limited experience, there could be 50-50, but that's what I've seen. And men tend to really like building products. I mean, we have them in our house. We see bathrooms and kitchens and patios with stone, and it's really cool medium. And you know, we think, gosh, that'd be a really neat business to have. I mean, you buy the stone at one price and sell it at a higher price, and you know, what's easier than that? So I had a lot of people interested in the business. It was very profitable. Been in business for a number of years, and they bought their raw materials. I mean, their materials from the Middle East, and it was shipped in container loads, these big vessels, and landed in Charleston Harbor or Savannah, and came up to the Carolinas. And everything seemed pretty easy. I mean, that's a really great business to want to sell, a profitable distribution business. And I started marketing it, got all the material and tax returns tied in. Everything was fine. And I had people interested in my write-up. And I didn't hide the fact that the material came from Syria and Turkey, but it was just kind of a throwaway line.
From my understanding, travertine and those type of stones, the only place in the world they're available is in that area, in Syria and Turkey, right?
I believe the material, travertine, in the quality that people would like, is only available in that part of the world. I think in Greece you can get some, but it's not the same quality. In comparing it, the price differential wasn't that great, that you wouldn't want to get the higher quality. So essentially, it was only available in that part of the world. So when buyers, they would look at the financial, look at the numbers, and look at the concept, and look at the pretty pictures, and see where this material was used outside for pavers and landscaping, and going through around houses and around pools and in bathrooms and showers and stuff. It really was cool. And the money was good and the price was fair. And some people said, well, Turkey, I'm not familiar with that. How would I relate to the people who were selling the material over there? How would I negotiate with them? And my buyer was not, his sons were running the business, and they were happy to agree to a period of time where they would go over to with the buyer to meet with all the vendors either before the sale or after the sale or both, and help them feel comfortable with the relationship with these mines. And as I would tell buyers, I mean, no one in the world is going to say, oh, I don't want to accept money from Americans. I mean, they're business people. They want to sell their goods. So they're not going to, and it's competitive because they're not, there's many, many mines around there. So they're not going to blackball somebody from America. They want to sell, but they were reluctant. So it reduced the number of potential buyers by 60-70%.
So I guess just for clarification here, we have a part of the world which is politically unstable. There's a war going on, has been for a number of years. And because of that fact, the business was still going on. He was still importing, and there weren't any real disruptions in supply. But because of perceived risk, no buyer wanted to follow up on that.
Exactly. That's very well said. And the only thing I'd add to it is that toward the end of my engagement, before I threw in the towel, so to speak, there was considerable reporting in the news of violence in Turkey and spilling over into Syria. I know the business is still operating, so I don't think it was a terminal situation for the business, especially, you know, if you come from that part of the world, you know where to go and where not to go.
You know, just like in this country, there's places you want to go and places you know you shouldn't go.
Absolutely. So it was no problem to them, but it was a problem to buyers. And looking back on it, maybe I should have looked at finding some sort of network of people from that part of the country who have immigrated to this country and are looking for businesses. I just look at traditional outlets to reach buyers. Maybe I should have gone to focus on a particular group of people who would have found that business as attractive as everyone else, but also wouldn't strike fear in their hearts about losing the supply of their raw material or their material that they just would buy and sell. So that's one thing. And I guess the other thing just is from a business owner's point of view, as time goes by, we're getting more and more people coming to this country from countries that didn't have as many flowing over here. We had Europeans for many, many years, and now we have Asians and people from India, Far East, and so it's going to be more and more of an issue. And it'll probably be a non-issue at some point in the future, but now it's one, whether you're buying or selling, you have to be aware that that's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, I think for me, there's a couple of takeaways here, Tom. I think that number one is that there are opportunities out there and there are obstacles almost in any business. It's actual perceived opportunity and risk. In this particular case, the perceived risk wasn't as high as the actual risk because business continued to go on, exporting continued on. Even though there was disruption and wars in that part of the world, it did go on. So that's probably one thing. But the other thing really is that people come to this country from other parts of the world and they have no experience. They have language barriers. They have cultural issues, but they're entrepreneurial and they buckle down and they build phenomenal businesses over time. And yet in this country, when we receive some obstacles, cultural differences and things like this, we aren't willing to pay the price that some other types of people that come to this country and really face insurmountable obstacles, but yet are able to overcome them because of sheer tenacity. And I think that's kind of a takeaway when you're buying a business. So you really have to understand what the real risks are and what the perceived risks are. The perceived risk might be greater than the actual risk. So these are some great stories I think you've shared with us here today, Tom. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing these stories and these transactions with us and what the outcomes were and some of the takeaways. If someone wanted to reach out to you and get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Gosh, they've got a really easy email address, Tom, T-O-M, at S-A-G, like Stephen Albert George dash U-S dot com. The website is summitacquisitions.com. And as long as you remember that there are four I's in acquisitions, you can probably put them in the right place. I have to make sure I put them in the right place every time I write it out.
That is your name of your company. So a good tip there for us trying to remember how to spell acquisitions. Well, it's been a great time here today with you, Tom. We'll have your contact information all shown in our show notes. And you can also go to thebusinessexitstories.com and you'll be able to find Tom's episode as well as others. So until next time, when we have more business exit stories, we'll see you then.
Thanks for inviting me, Marvin.
Join us in our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com, where you can find more information. Join us next time for more Business Exit Stories.